the Trails Foundation of Northern Utah's It's About the Trails podcast. I'm Eric Manning, the executive director here at the Trails Foundation, and I'm very excited today, episode number two. We're going to be talking about our 2023 author event that's held at the Timbermine Restaurant in Ogden. This event we try to do every year, sponsored by Elliot Hewlett and George Elliott Hall. You can find more information at tfnu.org, and we'll also have some links in the notes so you can follow along and check out and come to the event. So today with us, we've got Stephen Trimble. He tells stories in words and photographs. A writer, editor, and photographer, he's published 25 award-winning books during 45 years of paying attention to the landscapes and peoples of the Desert West. Steve was born in Denver, where he roamed the West with his family. His geologist father kept a running monologue about the natural and human history revealed by the land passing by the windows of their vehicle. And Steve grew up in a well-nourished sense of wonder. After a liberal arts education at Colorado College, he worked as a park ranger in Colorado and Utah, earned a master's degree in ecology at the University of Arizona, and served as director of the Museum of Northern Arizona Press. He's worked as a freelance writer and photographer since 1981 and has received numerous awards along the way for his work. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and bring on and welcome our guest, Stephen Trimble. Thanks for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be here, Eric.
This is an absolute pleasure, being able to go through your website, seeing all your work, really. I mean, photography, your writing, it's great. And it fits right into kind of some of what we're facing today as well. But you were ahead of the curve.
Well, I've been doing it for a long time. So yeah, it started a long time ago and I'm still doing it.
Well, we're definitely excited to have you on the podcast. And we're very excited to have you be at our 2023 author event on May 5th. In 2022, after 2 years, we brought our author event back. We had a little hiatus and we had Nate Schweber. He was the author, and his book that he just recently released right before the event was This America of Ours, Bernard and Avis DeVoto and the Forgotten Fight to Save the World. And your work is very, I don't know, kind of continuing with the DeVoto fight, if you will.
Oh, totally. I'm a huge fan of Bernard DeVoto. You know, he was really the predecessor and mentor for Wallace Stegner, who I think of as my mentor. And so generation to generation, you know, we keep getting passionate about the West, and DeVoto is not nearly as well known as he should be. So I thought Nate did a really good job in that book, and I was delighted to see it get as much attention as it did.
Yeah, he's been able to tour a little bit and talk about the book, and I know with DeVoto's close ties with our area, in the Ogden area, it was a little rocky, you could say, but the event went remarkably well. And Nate is so, he actually came to my wedding the day after the author event. I got married, and we invited him and he showed up.
So it was kind of,
and he signed my book and he even said, I'm at your wedding right now. So it's something I'll always remember.
Did he have an appropriate DeVoto quote to read at your wedding?
You know, actually, no, it was pretty low key. We were outside, but it was great to see him fit right in with everybody. He kind of fits into the world that I live in, and it was just wonderful having him here. And speaking of DeVoto, you've mentioned that you're a member of the Tribe of Benny. So what exactly is that?
Well, DeVoto's friends called him Benny. You know, it's like Wallace Stegner's friends called him Wally.
Yeah.
I knew Stegner a little bit. I can never quite bring myself to call him Wally. But DeVoto was so passionate and fierce about saving public lands in the West. And he, for years, wrote the Easy Chair column in Harper's, where he had this bully pulpit. And his book, 1846, The Year of Decision, is one of my favorite books. You know, it's very old now. But he was such a good writer and wrote about the land in a way that really made you know that he knew the place and he loved the place. He had mixed feelings about growing up in Ogden,
yep,
as a non-Mormon, but he loved the West. And I read his books when I was beginning my years as a writer, and he helped me understand the West in a way that really no one else did until I began to discover Wallace Stegner's books. You know, they are writers and experiencers. You know, they had a real passion for going out on the land they were writing about. They weren't writing as an academic sitting in a library on the East Coast without any real on-the-ground knowledge, that they knew these places. And their mix of field work and trying to get the words exactly right and really thinking hard about the nature and spirit of this Western landscape, this arid place that we call home, they were real models.
That's so great to hear you, because you fall in that same category, right? I mean, you live it, you know, you experience it, and you did that obviously well before you got into your photography and your writing. And in fact, in your book, Bargaining for Eden, The Fight for the Last Open Spaces in America, kind of follows along the same lines, right? You love the Red Rock country. It has nothing to do with that. It's more about, you know, here locally in the Ogden area, snow basin ski resort. But what motivated you to spend 10 years trying to figure out and understand snow basin owner Earl Holding's fight to acquire the public land in the build up to the Olympics in 2002?
Well, I went up to Snow Basin. So I grew up skiing. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up skiing in Colorado. And we raised our family in Salt Lake, where we skied mostly in the Cottonwoods, up in, you know, at Alta, mostly. And so I had never skied at Snow Basin, but in 1997, I got asked to take pictures for a travel story. So I was on assignment, following the writer around, interviewing people, when Snow Basin was still the funky local ski area that all of you in Ogden out there listening to this know and love, and remember what it was like. And those are the kinds of places I learned to ski, too. So I had huge affection for ski areas, and we call them ski areas, not ski resorts, where you kind of bumped up the mountain on a slow double chairlift. And I went up to Snow Basin with the writer for this assignment for a travel story for newspapers, back when they had travel sections. followed him around, and he asked questions of, you know, the head of the ski patrol and the mountain manager. And it was really an interesting story, and I had a good time taking the pictures, and I realized that, you know, this was 5 years before the 2002 Winter Olympics were going to come to Snow Basin, and they were going to have to transform this place. And so I initially thought, you know, there's a book here, and all I have to do is ask a simple question. What is it going to take to get a racer down the mountain in February 2002 when the downhill is run in the Salt Lake City Winter Olympics at Snow Basin? And so I went back that summer and started asking that question. And it turned out that the words Earl Holding were part of every answer. And I wasn't expecting that. And so very quickly, the book became not only tracking all the development it would take to create those downhill race courses, but getting really interested in the land trade that you mentioned, trading out public land that people here in the Ogden area really loved on the backside of Mount Ogden for commercial purposes, you know, for private land, privatizing public land, which is the opposite of what we think of as the public trust. That was land up in the Wheeler Basin that had been donated by the people of Ogden. Some of it was taken by eminent domain from ranchers who were still grumpy about it. I interviewed their families. But this was a place people really loved, and they hated what was happening. And Earl Holding was the most powerful and wealthiest person in the state at that point. And he was plugged into all the powerful politicians, and he got what he wanted. And so it became a fascinating story, fascinating to me, to follow every step of the development. And I learned a lot about what it takes to create a downhill course, and also to really understand how we managed to privatize this public land people cared so much about. And then in the middle of all that, my wife and I had been spending time in southern Utah forever. And we came across this piece of land that we decided to take a risk and buy. And the only way we could do that was to split it. You know, we bought a piece of land, carved off an existing house with some land around it. And I became a land developer, too. And so the Bargaining for Eden kind of plays with that tension between the billionaire land developer who owns hundreds of thousands of acres of the West and me.
Such a tight correspondence there, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So, I mean, what did you learn along the way? I think it's interesting because this area has changed a lot since 2002. Obviously, the Olympics had a big part to do with that, but we're also in the area known as kind of the outdoor mecca. If you like outdoors, this is the place to be. What are some of the things that you learned along the way that made that change? Because I think there's generally two sides to this, right? The people that are all for it, this is fantastic. We need this. And then, like you mentioned before, the people have been here a while, that Snow Basin was their ski area and then turned into a resort. I mean, what did you learn along the way that maybe, I don't know, maybe that kind of surprised you?
Well, I was a little bit surprised at how tight the political power structure is in Utah. Maybe I was naive. I didn't live full time in Utah until 1987. That's when I moved to Salt Lake City and got married. And sure, I knew that Utah had a limited number of people with a lot of power, but you know, a lot of those people who were in Congress at that time, they all went to high school together. You know.
Shared lockers.
Yeah. Earl Holding used to ride his bike around Salt Lake with Thomas Monson perched on the handlebars, who became the prophet of the LDS Church. You know, it was very small town in terms of power elite. And it really wasn't illegal. Earl was not bribing anyone to get what he wanted. And even though I never interviewed Earl Holding, I spent so much time thinking about him that I do call him Earl. You know, he died a few years ago, and it's probably a little bit of a gesture of disrespect, but he was my character. It was really, he became more of a character than a person in terms of the way I wrote the book, even though it was strictly nonfiction. And so the fact that powerful people really got their way was a surprise. And also, you know, I had really sort of worshipped those downhillers when I was a young skier myself. You know, Jean-Claude Killy back in the 1970s, winning all those gold medals. And to realize that the Olympics is really big business as much as anything. Sure, the athletes are doing their thing, and the athletes are heroic in some sense, but the Olympics is a business. And when it came to Utah, you know, those of us who lived here gloried in attending and having the world visit us and share it with us, but it was really being driven primarily as a kind of a commercial operation.
Well, it's interesting timing, too, because we're in the, you know, bidding for a future Olympics here in the area. So the timing is very similar. Obviously, there'll have to be more things that happen and take place to get us to that point. But from your transformation from 97 to 2002, when the Olympics did show up and you seeing that and you like being a part of it, really, you know, like covering it and everything, what are some of your takeaways from that? Like, what are some of the things that, again, not necessarily surprised you, but what are some of the things that maybe weren't part of the focus and slowly maybe morphed into that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the land trade was one of those things that I found especially intriguing. And at the very beginning, Earl said, I want a big chunk of this national forest for myself. I want to build hotels. I want to build condos. You know, I want to own the mountain. And so who has the right to own a mountain? So I began to explore that and, you know, I was able to interview people on all sides of that, including the, you know, the specialists and consultants who kind of greased the wheels for Earl when it went to Congress. And it was just the step-by-step that I found so intriguing. You know, Earl said, I want it all. And the Forest Service said, no, you can't have it all. You can have 200 acres. And we'll trade you for comparable value of land elsewhere that you will buy and give to the National Forest. And Earl just kept pushing. And the Forest Service moved a little bit more toward his position, a little bit more toward compromise, but he still wasn't getting what he wanted. And so he turned to Congress, and Congress gave him what he wanted. And so it was the kind of different power structures, how they all worked together. The Forest Service came off pretty well, in my estimation. There were mostly very ethical, very devoted people working for that agency. And I found the same thing with the Bureau of Land Management planners in Southern Utah that I followed as well in working on some of the plans for Red Rock Country that is also a part of the book. And so my dad worked for the U.S. Geological Survey, and I always thought of people who worked for government agencies as my heroes on some level, right back to John Wesley Powell. And I have to say that working on the book mostly verified that. You know, there were a few people that were more political, but and a few people with slightly different values, but those folks are trying to do the right thing.
Does it surprise you that things happened, and I say as quickly, right? I mean, you're talking a very short window of making this happen, right, before the Olympics. Timeline-wise, was it a surprise that it was able to happen so quickly?
Well, that was Earl's excuse, basically. Earl went to Congress and said, we have to have this land trade for the Olympics. That wasn't really true. He could have done everything he needed to do on Forest Service land and with a tiny footprint of private land. But it was a great excuse. And that time pressure is what he used when he went to Congress, and Jim Hansen and Orrin Hatch gave him what he wanted. And so it did happen fast. But he also had a lot of money. You know, he was paying cash for all this stuff. It was great for the Olympics to have Earl in charge of building those race courses. You know, he hired Bernard Roussy. I guess the Olympic Committee probably paid Bernard Roussy to design the courses, who was a famous Swiss downhiller. And it did happen very, very fast. That was one of the things that made it possible for me to do a book about it. You know, I couldn't track it for 20 years.
So do you think if it happened now, the same exact scenario happened today, do you think it would happen?
Oh, what an interesting question, Eric. I've never given that any thought. I imagine that it would.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think there's really an old-fashioned ski area to transform in quite that way. Skiing has become an even more elite sport. Enormously expensive to go skiing these days. And as we all know, enormously crowded, especially up in the Cottonwood Canyons. So it would be a different world, but, you know, the powerful do tend to have their way. So I suspect it might play out in kind of the same way.
So have you heard about the new changes of Snow Basin's getting ready to take on? Phase one with the development happening up there. Have you been aware of what's going on there?
A little bit. I'm sure you folks locally know way more than I do, but I know there will be a Club Med hotel,
yeah.
And the map of the build-out shows an awful lot of buildings at the base of that mountain.
What is that? How do you feel about that? Like, just from a personal experience and what you do?
Well, it's inevitable. I mean, Snow Basin is a business. And Earl Holding may have died, but his family still owns the place. And they've always imagined that they would have hotels and build homes. That was part of the planning. I was part of the committee deciding where that new entrance road would come in from Trapper's Loop.
Oh, wow.
And I wasn't on the committee, but I was invited to sit in on all the meetings and take notes and use that as part of my book project. And Earl and his people were very concerned about where the road was going to go in terms of how that would play out in terms of their housing development, their residential development. So they've been thinking about it all along. But it's been 20 years since the Olympics.
Yeah.
And so it's taken a while, taken a whole generation to get to this point.
Well, and I think there's a lot of, when they started to roll this out, like you mentioned again, is just that ski area feel and, you know, people growing up there that are still in the area. So it's been met with a lot of, I don't say resistance because you can't really, you know, it's going to happen, right? But it's been met with a lot of begrudging acceptance. Maybe that's the word. But I think it kind of goes to what you're saying. Skiing is becoming, you know, almost a little too much for the normal skier to go do anymore, you know?
I think that's right. And really hard for kids to learn now. You know, their family, a whole family to go skiing, it's just a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, that, and when you talked about the change from resistance to grudging acceptance, I saw that happen in those years. You know, when I first started interviewing people, you know, they were saying, I refuse to ever ski there again. You know, people were never going to buy gas from Sinclair Oil ever again, which was another one of Earl Holding's businesses. Many of them, by the end of my project, were saying, well, it's a pretty cool place to ski. We're going to go back.
Well, and we've heard the same thing since the announcement of the phases, people saying, I'm not going to ski there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, realistically, that's not the case. You might have a few holdouts, mm-hmm. but I think overall, it's still going to happen. You know, and it is, like you said, it's a business, right? It's a business. They run a business. They're trying to do the future, you know, carry on the legacies, whatever that is. But in the book, Bargaining for Eden, you wrote, on some levels, I am Earl. We're all Earl. What did you mean by that?
Well, I was partly talking about this land in southern Utah that my wife and I bought, where we split the land and I became a land developer and I became a land owner. You know, I had never owned land other than, you know, the little tiny lot underneath my house in Salt Lake. And I had the chance to discover this amazing piece of land just outside Capitol Reef National Park, where I'd worked as a ranger in my 20s. You know, that was my landscape. And I took a look at this land and said, this is unbelievable. This is an amazing opportunity to have a permanent footprint here. And we bought a piece of land that really could be part of the national park. So I became someone who owned land in the way that Earl owned land. And I went beyond being a pilgrim, an urban pilgrim to the wilderness, whose passion was public lands, to also being a taxpayer in Wayne County and having issues with the way that those property taxes might play out. And so many of Earl's concerns on a gigantic scale became my concerns on a tiny scale. And I think all of us have desires. You know, we have desires to own things and to be to have a sense of permanence about our home. You know, it's really a lot about privilege. So many people, especially these days, can't afford to buy a home, let alone to consider buying a vacation home or a piece of land somewhere out in the boondocks. But you know, there's a real strong connection, I think, for all of us between having a piece of land that we do call home and where we go and spend time and watch the seasons change. And Earl Holding enjoyed that too. He had a ranch outside Yellowstone that was his favorite place. And especially after he had a stroke and was somewhat debilitated, he spent a lot of time there just being there.
So what have we learned any lessons about protecting wild lands in Utah in the last two decades?
Oh, my. You know, part of what happened right about the time I was working on Bargaining for Eden was President Clinton declaring Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. And then along came President Obama, who declared Bears Ears National Monument. And I absolutely cheered and gloried in both of those moments. And as we well know, the Utah political establishment did not, and persuaded the former president to eviscerate both of those monuments. And now President Biden has restored them. And what is the state of Utah doing? They are suing to yet again dissolve those protections for these places. So have we learned anything? It depends on who you mean by we. But the elected officials and the county commissioners in rural Utah are taking exactly the same position on states' rights and having their way and hating federal intervention and regulation and designation. It hasn't changed at all. But I think support from the people has changed. You know, the Colorado College State of the Rockies project evaluates conservation attitudes around the West every year, and they see nothing but support for conservation, for national monument designation, even in Utah, in the general population. You know, pretty much all the way through, the people of Utah have wanted to keep those protections in place, to preserve the monuments, to save the monuments. And it's really the elected officials, the political powers that be, who are very much connected to corporations and people that want to mine coal or mine uranium or, you know, log trees, extractive industry, that power structure, those are the folks that are saying, no, 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 we do not want protection. We want to have access. We want to have access to all of that land for potential profit.
Well, that's what it comes down to, even in the early years with the Olympics, is business, right? Mm-hmm. Like all of the things you just mentioned is more of a business decision or a, you know, conserve it. Right? It's just one side or the other. Mm-hmm. When you did your book, Bargaining for Eden, obviously, you know, it took some time talking to people locally. What was the biggest concern that people had with the Olympics coming here? Was it the development? Was it the crowds? Was it, you know, pricing? I mean, what were some of the things that you dealt with and heard about?
You know, people were most upset by the ethics of Earl getting what he wanted, of going on an end run around, you know, regulations and the Environmental Protection Agency and getting what he wanted from Congress. It wasn't so much that what he did was wrong. It was how he did it. That's what people were most upset about. You know, there were certainly people who didn't want to see any development there, but that wasn't going to happen. You know, the Olympics were coming. And everyone agrees that Earl Holding built beautiful resorts at the absolute peak of quality. And all of us who go up to Snow Basin today can absolutely see the results of that. So it was really the ethics that people were most concerned about, and the fact that their voices weren't heard. You know, I went to a meeting at the Ogden high school auditorium about the proposed gondola that was going to go from town up to Mount Ogden. And, you know, people were so emotional about their investment, their emotional investment in that mountain, and wanting to see things done right and wanting a voice. And in the end, of course, that didn't happen. But it was really, really striking to me how deeply people cared about doing things right.
That's good to hear, though.
Yeah.
Not just doing it right, but maybe even doing it for the right reasons, right? And that's different for everybody.
That's right.
But when you have a community, and that's something that I know we here locally hang our hat on, is our community. When you have a community that buys in and believes in something, there's a lot of power there. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of familiarity with one another to make things, in your eyes, right.
Yeah, and you know, I hope you can hang on to that, because I was doing these interviews 25 years ago. That's astonishing to me. That's one of the things I'll talk about when I do the talk for you guys in May, is the amount of change that's happened in these years that just kind of disappeared in my life and in everybody else's life too. But, you know, I was able to interview the old timers that really began the ski area in the 30s. You know, I interviewed Corey Engen, one of the Engen brothers, and one of the guys whose family had homesteaded in Wheeler Basin right after World War I.
Wow.
And a lot of those old timers who taught in the ski patrol and taught in the ski school, ran the ski patrol, taught in the ski school, they're all gone now. You know, they were gone, they started disappearing even as I was talking with them. And so we're a generation out, and that's history now. And so how do you hang on to your community? That's the challenge.
Well, and I think some of that, to me, is hanging on to your history, right? If people don't know the history, it becomes forgotten. I think when people understand and know the history, I think there's more power there, because you maybe have a little bit of an attachment to that, right?
I certainly believe that. I mean, that's my whole career, is trying to highlight things like that.
So when you highlight it through photography and you highlight it through your writing, do you find that I'm trying to find the right words here, by doing those together, do you think there's a little bit more power in what you can show, can say?
Sure. Yeah. I'm a storyteller in both words and photographs. You know, as a photographer, I'm not an art photographer. I call myself an editorial photographer. You know, I'm trying to tell the story with pictures, with photographs. And that gives me two ways of doing things. It also makes it way more fun to do field work. You know, if the light's great, I take pictures. And if the light's terrible, I get out my journal and take notes. And both of those things are going to feed into a book project.
So your career began in 1975. You took a job as a seasonal park ranger at Capitol Reef National Park. You call that your spiritual home. What continues to attract you to that, one of the least known national parks in Utah? We had this discussion.
Well, the very fact that it is one of the least known means that we have it to ourselves a lot of the time. So I started coming to the Canyon Country as a kid. You know, you mentioned my dad had been, or I guess I mentioned my dad had been working for the U.S. Geological Survey as an old-time field geologist. And every vacation from our home in Denver, we would visit the national parks. And we came to Arches and Canyonlands and Zion and Bryce and Capitol Reef when I was a kid. All we did was drive through Capitol Reef, which is what most people do.
Yep.
My mom was not into camping. But, you know, in college, I did a lot of hiking and backpacking and mountaineering. And right out of college, I started working as a park ranger. And I love the mountains. I grew up in Colorado. I love the Colorado mountains. I did some park rangering in the Northwest. But it's that canyon country, the slick rock, red rock country, that somehow just strikes a chord in my soul. I just feel wonderful being surrounded by slick rock and being somewhere where there's a little rivulet of water coming down through, and there's a spring or two with maidenhair fern and orchids and canyon tree frogs. And, you know, it's a magical, magical place. And it's huge. You know, none of us will ever be able to explore all of that country in southern Utah. And so Capitol Reef was the place that I worked for one season, came back a couple years after that and did a little book for the park and got to know it pretty well, but just kept going back year after year after year. And, You know, a couple of years ago, there was a campaign, I think run by Subaru, saying, find your park. You know, I know my park. Capitol Reef is my park, even though I've written about and visited many, many, many other national parks. And so I know it pretty well. There are a million places in the park I've never been that I will never be able to get to. It's a big place. And that's extraordinary, you know, to just be able to go out of an afternoon and look at the map and think, you know, I've been up that wash, but I've never taken that branch. There's got to be something interesting up there. Let's go see. So exploring is something that we can still do in Southern Utah and come to places where we can imagine there haven't been any, a lot of other human beings in a long, long time.
Well, we're fortunate that we do have so many national parks here in Utah. What and why do you think Capitol Reef is that lesser known? Is it because of how it's not developed in commercial ways, whether it's food or places to stay or, you know, that type of thing? Is that, I mean, why is it?
Well, it's really just too isolated. You know, Zion and Bryce are just off an interstate. And there was a railroad tour company in the early 1900s that did a circle from Grand Canyon up to Zion and Bryce. And, you know, people would stay at those lovely old lodges. Zion and Bryce were very much part of that, the early years of people discovering the national parks. And Arches is visited, I think, a lot by people from Colorado. You know, it's right off the highway, right off the interstate, easily accessible from Denver. And then Ed Abbey came along and wrote Desert Solitaire and made Arches the icon of the desert wilderness and attracted a bunch of young people like me to Arches and Moab. And then the mountain bike community discovered it. And Canyonlands is just right next door. Canyonlands is still the least visited of the parks, but it's better known because of its proximity to Arches and being right on the edge of all that mountain bike country. So Capitol Reef has never had any of that. It's more isolated, farther from interstates, farther from any major towns, not a particularly great place for mountain biking surrounding the park. You know, it's a hiker's place. And so I think that's why it's the in-between place.
Well, we won't touch on it because it's a tricky one, but being, you know, Arches and Canyonlands being right next to Moab with the amount of visitorship there, it's easy to get to, you know, where we see it here a lot. There's like the cameras that say, oh, you can't get in the park today because the line's too long. You just don't see that. And in Capitol Reef, there's not a ticket station, right?
Yeah, they made a deal when Highway 24, the Utah State Highway, went through the park, the state made a deal with the park that they wouldn't charge an entry fee.
That's still just baffling to a lot of people, right? Mm-hmm. It's a national park, and you can access this beautiful landscape for nothing,
mm-hmm.
Right?
It's pretty remarkable.
And they have the fun little orchards down there that you can go in. I mean, it's just, it's a magical place.
Well, I've been taking pictures there now for 45 years or more, and I had the chance to do my sort of love letter to Capitol Reef. A couple of years ago, I edited the Capitol Reef Reader, which is an anthology of all the best writing about Capitol Reef. So I got to find the pieces and find the right excerpt to highlight the best of that writing and then illustrate the book with my photographs. And it was just a joy to pull that all together. And, you know, totally my love letter to the park.
I love that. I actually love how you say that, my love letter to the park, because it's well said. It sounds amazing. So we talk about a lot about the West. We talked about bargaining for Eden. The West as a whole right now, you know, we're in a tricky spot. You know, we've up here, we've got a lot of snow. So people are saying, oh, we need the water. We're getting it all at once. From your years of doing what you do through writing, through photography, here in the West, the desert West, what do you think? What's going on?
You ask simple questions, huh, Eric?
Well, they're easy. Straight shots.
That's right. We have to come to terms with the arid heart of our home. This is not a wet place. This is not a green place. This is a dry place. You know, a huge chunk of the West is the Colorado River Basin, and the Colorado is running dry. And we built these huge cities like Phoenix, dependent on Colorado River water. And the Colorado River water system goes all the way to L.A. The river doesn't go to L.A., but L.A. drains water out of that system. And the Colorado is just generating less and less water every year. You know, the climate is warming. Reno has increased in average temperature by 10 degrees in the last few decades, more than any other Western city. What I'm working on right now is updating my book on the Great Basin, the Sagebrush Ocean, my natural history of the Great Basin. And so I'm doing a lot of research about all the changes that have happened since the first edition 35 years ago.
Wow.
You have to learn a lot of new science. But I'm trying to figure out actually how to make the title reflect the change. Just a couple of days ago, I had the idea of putting an asterisk next to the word sagebrush in the title, because every year the West loses more than 1 million acres of sagebrush. We've lost half of the sagebrush ocean. And you know, why have we lost it? It isn't just climate change. You know, what happens is this vicious cycle, you know, with intensive grazing, especially in inappropriate places, the biological soil crust gets destroyed, the native bunch grasses get trampled, and cheatgrass comes in. And as you drive through sagebrush country now, you see these rolling hills that are just golden and beautiful in the sunlight. It's all cheatgrass. It's all this introduced grass that has displaced the native vegetation, and it burns like crazy. And so when you get fire, the first thing to come back after the fire is not sagebrush. It's not native bunch grass. It's cheatgrass. And so the cheatgrass comes in. It's not particularly good forage for any native animals. Fire maintains it. 61 million of Nevada's 70 million acres have been overrun by cheatgrass on public lands. And so the natural landscape is changing drastically, and climate change is making the West more and more arid. And at the same time, all these, in every state is increasing in population, and California is sending people out to the more rural parts of the West in droves, and it's getting more and more difficult for people to be able to afford to buy a house in places like Bozeman or Boise or even in Ogden. Mm-hmm. And so I've just told us what it looks like now. I have no solution. I don't know how we get out of this. But the one thing we have to do is admit that we can't grow endlessly. You know, that's not possible in a place with too little water and with climate change accelerating. And even if we, you know, kind of pull back a little bit on our emissions and climate change doesn't accelerate quite so much, all of these things are set in place. They're set in motion. You know, I was deeply discouraged by the Utah State Legislature session that just ended. You know, they were told by every expert, we've got to get water to the Great Salt Lake now. Mm-hmm. And they didn't do it. You know, they did some work around the edges. They created a Great Salt Lake Commission and a Great Salt Lake Commissioner to oversee change. They did some work on urban conservation of water. But we've got to get more water into the lake, and the only way we can really do that is to decrease the diversions that we're using, where we're using water for agriculture. You know, 3/4 of the water that doesn't make it into the lake is diverted for agriculture, and much of that is for alfalfa. And alfalfa contributes 0.02% to our economy in the state. And so it's perfectly clear what we need to do, but we don't have the will to do it. To just keep the lake alive. That's one single place in the West.
And it's such a monumental landmark place in itself. As a youth, I just remember it would flood, you know, and you'd come up high, and now it's, you don't see water there anymore. And I think back to what you said earlier, which I think is something that I wish more people would understand is, you know, when you're here in Ogden, you don't think of desert. You've got beautiful mountains. You've got forests, you've got snow-capped peaks, you've got all this, but you're still, it's still desert. The Wasatch Front, same thing. It looks gorgeous and green and for the most part, but you're still in a desert. And I don't think people cross the two together enough. They think desert, they think Moab, you know, they think Red Rocks.
That's right. Yeah, I'm actually grumpy about calling Southern Utah a desert because the Colorado Plateau is not officially a desert, according to the ecologists, but we live in a desert here. You know, we don't enter the mountains until we get to the mouth of Ogden Canyon. You know, that's where the mountains start. And when we look west, we're looking 500 miles across the Great Basin Desert all the way to Reno. And so the Great Salt Lake is, as you said, the iconic lake of the Great Basin Desert. And its maximum depth is 30 feet. And if you drop it 1 foot, you expose many, many, many square miles. And so you have this giant saucer of a lake, and every few feet up or down makes a huge difference. You know, it's not like you're dealing with Lake Tahoe that's hundreds of feet deep. And so when we say we need to get more water to the lake, we really need to get more water to the lake, because as we drop down to these historic lows and expose these hundreds of miles of lake bed filled with all of the minerals and arsenic and toxic substances that have been pouring into that lake for literally tens of thousands of years and get stuck there because the lake, of course, has no outlet. You expose them to the wind, and they're going to blow where the prevailing winds, they're coming from the west, they're going to blow right into your window.
So, and there's been a lot more writing and coverage and talking about the Great Salt Lake, you know, more people. It's because it's obviously getting worse. You know, you talked about it a little bit ago. It's been set in motion. I know this is not a question you can answer, but it's almost like, when is it too late, right? Like, when is it like irreversible, you know, because we're already looking at it the way it is now, set in motion. Obviously the legislature, as you mentioned, didn't think enough, put enough stock into it to make that change. I mean, is there a point where it's like, it's too late now?
We may have already hit that point. According to Bonnie Baxter, who's head of the Great Salt Lake Institute at Westminster College, she studies the animals that depend on the lake, you know, the algae and the absolute bedrock of the food chain that leads to the brine flies and the brine shrimp, which feed the tens of thousands, you know, millions of birds that depend on the lake to stock up on fat reserves before they fly all the way to South America. You know, the lake really matters in terms of the conservation of waterfowl across the whole continent. And we have already disrupted those food chains. You know, there are fewer brine flies. The fowl ropes are not doing as well. The waterfowl that come, the shorebirds that come to stock up and fatten up. It may be that we've already hit that point. And if we get water back, that's what she kept telling the legislators. If we can get water back into the lake this year, we can probably pull back from that brink. But if we don't do it this year, maybe not.
That's just hard to hear. Mm-hmm. It really is.
It really is.
And I don't want to get too down that road, because it is. It's hard to hear. So I'm going to shift gears now. I got to block that out and shift gears just a little bit.
Okay.
Let's talk about a project that's not like something you've ever done before, the mic file. So this is completely different than all of your other work. Talk about that a little bit. What the mic file?
So my most recent book is a memoir. When I was a kid, I had a brother who was 8 years older than me. He was my mom's child from a brief first marriage. Mike was 5 years old when my parents got married, and I came along 3 years after that. And as every little kid does, I adored my big brother. He was a sweet kid, and he lived at home until he was 14. But as he approached adolescence, he had been diagnosed as slow to learn, and he was struggling in school. And as he approached adolescence, he had what we would call a psychotic break and became really dangerous. His anger was scary. And my parents were at wit's end, and they ended up going to court in Colorado. And Mike was committed to the Colorado State Hospital. And so he left home when I was 6, and he never lived at home again. And he lived at the Colorado State Hospital for about 10 years and then was mainstreamed back to Denver in those years when we were emptying out the mental institutions. And he lived in halfway houses and boarding houses in Denver for about 10 years, didn't want to have anything to do with us, and then died in kind of tragic circumstances in his early 30s back in 1976. So Mike's story was the tragedy of our family, and certainly the tragedy of my mother's life. And she never wanted to talk about it. You know, you don't want to talk about tragedy. And he died so long ago that he became someone that just didn't seem like a very big part of my life. If you asked me if I had any siblings, I had a little mantra. Yeah, I had a brother, a half-brother, who left home when I was young and was mentally ill and died years ago. And most people are not going to follow up on that, you know. And so over the years, I really didn't give Mike a lot of thought and repeated that mantra. And my mother died and my father died. But they had saved this envelope of letters and records, really fragmentary records, medical records about Mike, that we called the Mike file. And it was deathless, you know. It was still there in my dad's files when he died, even though we thought it might have been thrown away along the way. And so about a year after my dad died, I thought, I really want to see what's in there. I want to grapple with this and see where it goes. And indeed, over the years, my writing friends and family had said to me repeatedly, you know, Steve, this is the best material you have as a writer. This is emotionally powerful stuff. You know, what happened to Mike? What did it mean to you? And so I started working on what became this published book, The Mike File, about 10 years ago now. And I didn't know where it was going to go. And I started with the easy stuff. I started with research because that's what I know how to do as a nonfiction writer. I thought, okay, who was my mom when she gave birth to my brother at 20? When my mom was 20, you know, she grew up in Jewish immigrant families in Montana and eventually met a guy and moved to Denver where he had grown up. That's how she ended up in Denver. I knew nothing about him other than his name when I started the project. So I researched Jewish immigration to Montana, and I researched my family history, and I wrote all this stuff that was really fun to figure out. And my readers, who were reading those early drafts, couldn't get through it. It was just a block. They wanted to get to Mike's story. They wanted to know what Mike meant to me. So it literally took me years to believe them and to finally get to where I could begin to grapple with, what did Mike mean to me? What was Mike's emotional effect on me? And that's what the book became. That's what the book is about.
Wow, that's a special project. But again, a lot different than what you have done before.
Completely different, but you know, writers love to write about new things. Every project I've worked on really has been about things that I didn't know a whole lot about when I started. They were more connected to what you might predict than the Mike file, but I love to start a project not knowing where it's going to go, and I have the joy of learning about it.
Did you, when you were finishing with that, did you come away fulfilled? Did you get what you wanted out of that? Not necessarily what the reader did, but I mean, did you walk away from that fulfilled?
I did. That's a really powerful question, Eric. I did, and what I realized I was reaching for was empathy. I was trying to understand Mike's life. You know, what was it like to live in the Colorado State Hospital when there were 6,000 patients there as a young kid, as a teenager? You know, what was it like to live by yourself in halfway houses, bitterly resentful of having been banished from our family? You know, I didn't understand Mike's emotions. I never gave them a lot of thought. And I certainly didn't think about my reacting to Mike by trying to be the good kid, by trying not to be not Mike. And so I think I really did reach the point where I felt like I reclaimed Mike from the past. I sort of did it as a gesture of respect. And I learned an awful lot more about myself. And those two things were incredibly powerful.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. So speaking of, you know, you just touched on that with projects and things. Right now, coming up for you, is your next project the one you're working on now? You mentioned earlier, you know, the 35th anniversary of your book. Is that your project now?
Yeah, it is. You know, The Sagebrush Ocean is, you know, it's a big book, full-length book, looking at all the communities of life from the bottoms of playas up to the bristlecone pines, you know, fringing the tops of those mountains out there in the Great Basin. It was a joy to work on. It was really my first big full-length book that I worked on in the 1980s when I was in my 30s and beginning the kind of real substantial part of my career. And I spent a lot of time out there by myself. And really think of it as a place where I sort of came of age as a full-blown writer and photographer. So it's wonderful to go back to it. And now I have to update it all and figure out, okay, whatever I said about Sagebrush then, that's not really true anymore. You know, what I said about the Great Salt Lake, then I was talking about the lake at its maximum, you know, flooding State Street in Salt Lake City, threatening the Salt Lake Airport with its waters. You know, that happened, and then the lake started to decline again. And it's going to keep going down unless we change things. So it's really, really fun, but a little bit daunting. And yet, one of the huge changes is how I get new information. You know, I was doing my research in libraries in the 1980s. You know, I was living in Santa Fe at that point. I would drive to Reno and spend a couple of weeks working in the university library just to find the sources. And now I sit at my desk in Salt Lake City, and the internet provides me nearly everything I need. I'm still working in libraries and interviewing experts, but, you know, Google Scholar is powerful.
But there's probably, as powerful it is, there's probably just that piece of talking to the person, right, or the individual, or figuring that research out that is hard to compare.
My work is very much interview-based. I love looking for quotes when I talk with people. And what the research on Google Scholar will do is lead me to the people that I need to interview. You know, the one or two people that are doing the most interesting work, that know the most, whose words I need to guide me.
When you work on a project like this, knowing what you want to get, do you put a timeline, a deadline on something like this, or is it, or do you like to say, well, I'll know when it's ready?
My publisher certainly put deadlines on things. If I have a contract for a book, there is a deadline.
Yeah.
In the past, I have often not met those deadlines because the books were just too big to meet the deadlines. But a project like the Mike File, I worked on without a contract and worked on it until I had something I thought was done. And then I would start submitting it. And that often takes a long time, too, to find someone who wants it. And that what they want may not be quite what I wrote. So then there's rewriting involved. But the editing and rewriting is one of the great joys of the work.
Redoing it.
Rewriting. not redoing it, but, you know, you can always go back and find just a few words that make it a little bit better. Get rid of a few words, change a few words.
But this new project that you're working on, there's going to be, like you mentioned, there's a lot of change.
There's a lot of change. And my challenge, you know, I'm working from the original text, which is still pretty good, thank God. I don't know whether the fact that my style hasn't changed all that much, I don't know whether that means that I haven't really learned much or progressed much, or whether it just means that I was pretty good back then. But yeah, I'm starting with the existing text and updating it.
Okay, so we're kind of running close to time, but what three books would you recommend to our audience? This is always great. We know what you write, what you're about. What are three books that you recommend?
Well, when you asked me that in prep for this, one of the books I mentioned was Bargaining for Eden, and we've already talked a lot about that. When I travel as a writer outside of Utah, I always look for an opportunity to talk about Ellen Malloy's work. Ellen Malloy, that's Melloy, is not nearly as well known as she should be, and I think she's the best of our Utah writers. Oh. She died way too young, in her 50s, maybe 10 years ago, but she lived in Bluff. She was married to Mark Malloy, who was the San Juan River Ranger after having been the River Ranger in Gray and Desolation Canyons. And so she had a very powerful connection to the land and to the rivers. And she was really smart and a wonderful writer and wonderfully self-deprecatory. And so she combined all the things that I think of that make great writing. You know, she was smart. She did her research well. She got everything right. You know, she did not get sloppy with facts. She did tons of field work and was incredibly observant and sensitive. And she was a wonderfully adept writer. And she was funny. And her ego was not the first thing that you encountered in her work. So in her book, The Anthropology of Turquoise, which is the book I'd recommend you all start with, for instance, one of the essays starts with her stapling her hair to the roof while she's working on re-roofing her place in Bluff. Another of the essays about the river happens, the crucial action happens when she's on the river in a raft by herself, and she sees something interesting on shore, and she pulls over and she doesn't tie in. And the something interesting turns out to be a rubber ducky lodged in the driftwood. And by the time she gets back to her boat, it's floated away. And so she uses her own mistakes, you know, her own kind of silliness to propel you into being charmed. And then she takes you somewhere you never knew you were going to go. So it's a great book. And another book that I always wanted to take people back to is Wallace Stegner's Beyond the 100th Meridian, his book about John Wesley Powell. It's an old book from the 1950s. There have been many books about John Wesley Powell written since then. But Stegner is still someone who understood our part of the West just about as well as anybody ever has. Another wonderful writer. And he takes you down the river with John Wesley Powell, the first explorer of the Colorado River, you know, from the Green up in Wyoming all the way through the Grand Canyon, you know, the first white explorer who wrote about it. And he uses that to talk about what is the essence of this dry landscape? What is the Colorado Plateau? What do our deserts mean to us as a place to live? Really powerful book still.
Wow. Some great books. And we're gonna link those because those all sound fascinating books. Well, again, thank you. What can our audience, what can our listeners and our soon-to-be ticket purchasers, what can they look forward to on May 5th when you come to the Timbermine and talk?
Well, I hope I don't just repeat myself from what we said here. It all boils down to something I realized when I turned 70. I turned 70 during the pandemic, which was a weird time to turn 70, and turning 70 is a weird thing to happen. But as I was thinking about all that and doing research for a variety of different writing projects, I realized that the geologists have decided that the Anthropocene, you know, this new geologic era that we're in that is defined by the human impact on our planet, began in 1950. Their best guess is that that's about when we can find traces of nuclear fallout in the rocks. We can find this great acceleration of industrial traces of people in the rocks, you know, fly ash from burning coal. You know, they call it the Great Acceleration after World War II. So the Anthropocene began in 1950. I was born in 1950. I am the Anthropocene. And so the idea that this era that I've lived through is an era of humans dominating the earth makes me think about the kind of changes we talked about, you know, the kind of generational change at Snow Basin Ski Area, the changes in the Great Basin Desert, the changes in the Colorado Mountains, where when I climbed a 14er when I was in college, we were always the only people on the top of that mountain. And now you wait in line. You know, those kinds of drastic changes in the West are going to be my theme.
Well, I know I'm looking forward to it. I get to be there. Again, that's May 5th at the Timbermine Restaurant. We'll have some more links on our website there at tfnu.org. There's plenty of seats available. This is a fundraiser for us, so we'd love to see you there. We'll also have more information about Stephen on our website and links, so you can check it out at Stephen, that's a PH, StephenTrimble.net, so you can see much more about him and his writing and his photography and everything he does. But this has been an absolute pleasure sitting here with you, hearing so many great stories and anecdotes, and I'm very much looking forward to more. Your books especially, they're very much pique my interest.
Well, thank you, Eric. And it's an honor to be able to help to raise some money for the Trails folks, for you. And I'm looking forward to seeing all of you at that event. And it was great to talk with you. Really fun.
Yeah.
Really good questions.
This is something that I could easily say could go on for a much longer amount of time, just talking with you and your experience. And I do like that, you know, you really do the research. You know, like you mentioned, I love it if you're in the field writing about what you're experiencing and not necessarily what you're just seeing. Is that, you know, I think there's a big difference there, and I think a lot of times people catch that, and it just takes that next level to appreciation. So thank you again for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. I was delighted to be here.
All right, and we'll have more information, like I mentioned, on our website and our show notes. Thank you so much for being a part of that, and we'll see you again on May 5th.
You bet.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Trails Foundation of Northern Utah's It's About the Trails podcast, and a special thank you to our guest, author Stephen Trimble, for taking the time to join us today. We also want to invite everybody to our 2023 author event that will be held on May 5th at the Timbermine Restaurant in Ogden, and that is sponsored by Elliot Hewlett and George Elliott Hall. You can find more information at tfnu.org. We still have tables available, individual seats, VIP tickets, and sponsorships available. For more questions, please message us at tfnu at tfnu.org. Thanks for listening to our podcast, and remember, trails are for everyone. I'm Eric, and I hope to see you out on the trails.